Let's resume where we were, and I'm going to finish up in just a few minutes the recurrence, and then we'll start Intro to Trees. And as I mentioned, at the end of today's lecture, that'll be the breakpoint for material for the midterm. So it turns out that'll give you a chance to do some preparation and have some questions when midterm week comes in 2 weeks. And everything not covered, of course, will be covered in the final. Generally, what will happen is the final will not be cumulative, except in the sense that in the final, I'm perfectly willing to ask about lists if they involve something that's part of the second half of the semester. So we might talk about sorting, and of course, sorting oftentimes use lists. But the focus on material covered in the first half will be in the first half, and the second half will make the final more like a second midterm. And again, that will have 2 dates, too. Unfortunately, because of the way the semester ran, we had a very late Labor Day this year, which means that I think the second exam will be fairly close to Christmas. Now, does EPIC close down at Christmas time or near Christmas time or anything like that? Or you mean you got to come in here on the 25th and get your sack of coal and bah humbug as somebody dresses up like Ebenezer Scrooge instead of like I Love Lucy or... No, I don't know the situation. Well, anyway, and so I apologize on that, but we'll have 2 exams, and if you want to get away for Christmas or Christmas holidays, there will be an earlier exam. But just to make it possible to have the material fit in, hit the end of the semester, and then give you a chance for a second exam, we will have one a little bit later. That's all on the notes we gave the first time. But I just want to kind of explain that in advance, because this is about the time when people will be booking their holiday trips, particularly if you're planning going out of the country, and we'll try to set things up so you can get away as soon as possible. I think at least one person who had to get away in early December, and that individual, I think, was going to hand in some final projects and some exams remotely. So even that's a possibility if it has to be done. Certainly if you have a month scheduled on Riviera or, you know, in some other terrific place, Hawaii for a month is not half bad, as long as it's not raining. So if you got that set up, I'll just wish I was along with you, but we'll try to accommodate that. So at any rate, what we had done is we were trying to again show how you work this recurrence relations. So what we did here in the table is put some values up and simply go through the first couple of cases of how many steps were needed. And what we noticed is the steps increased by 1 every second value. That's because when we strip away the characters, we do 2 of them at a time, the front and the rear. And therefore, for something to require an extra recursion, it's the case you have to get down to a length 2 less instead of 1 less. So at any rate, by looking at this pattern, a good guess is that the overall time to do a string of length n is 1 plus n over 2. And again, if there's a fraction, you can round it in either direction. It's going to be value of only a fraction of 1 unit, so it doesn't really matter. So what we want to do is verify that this guess works. So our guess is that... Let me go back here. Yeah, that's right. So the pattern we guess is T of n equals 1 plus T of n minus 2. That's the original recurrence relation, simply saying that we need the overhead to check against the special case. And then if we decide we do need to do a recursion, we go around and call it 2 less instead of 1. So that's the recurrence relation, and this is our guesstimated formula. The difference here, these two, is notice they both begin T of n, but this one gives you a complete formula. So if you said, okay, n is 100, well, 100 divided by 2 is 50, so it's going to be about 51 units. This case, I have to say, well, I have to go back and figure out what T of n is, n minus 2 is, add 1 to it, and go backwards step by step by step. So this is my starting point, but this is actually the final formula, the one I want, so that I can actually plug in. So we're guessing that, we're going to verify that the final fits that starting rule. So what I do is I say, T of n, I'm guessing right here, is 1 plus n over 2. And then I'm saying, I don't know if that's equal or not yet. I changed it the other direction. Okay, yeah, here's where we want to be. Okay, so in this particular case, I'm going to say, well, here's the 1 from this part, plus I have to do t of n minus 2. So that comes out to be 1 plus 1 plus n over n minus 2. Sorry about that. Divided by 2 if my mathematics copied properly. In carrying this forward, this is 2 plus n divided by 2 minus 1. And what I do here is that's equal to 1 plus n over 2, doing the subtraction with respect to that. So if I did my plugging and chugging properly, that all matches. And a little old red mark says that. I'm hoping that it's all correct. But basically all I do is substitute in, simplify using algebra, and get the expected answer, we hope. So any questions on that? So that's all I needed to say about that. So what I'm going to be talking about is a little bit about searching and then more about introduction to trees. So searching is one of these operations we do all the time. Certainly in your business, you do it, probably that's your core operation, is to look up information, be it patient information, billing information, location information. Computing is a lot about that. And in some sense, the whole world is one great Google query about tell me this or tell me that. So we're going to search for a value, but what we're going to show is that there are some better ways and some inferior ways to do searching. So the most obvious and probably the least usable is what's called sequential search. You simply keep looking until you find a match. And if you're one of these people who, for example, puts all your receipts in a big cardboard box, and when tax time comes, you say, oh my gosh, I visited a dentist and he really gave me an unbelievable bill. I better find that and see if it's deductible. And if you're really sharp, you have all these nice filing things, medical and business and professional and personal and all that. Not me. I just throw it in a box. Say, if I need it, I'll find it. If I don't need it, then I don't have to worry about it. So that's exhaustive search. It works, but it's not all that great. If you have iterators, and we've seen that, at least that's a spot start, because now at least it'll give me everything in there. So I can imagine having a partner say, give me the next one. Is that from the dentist? No. Give me the next one? No. Finally find the bill from the dentist and get the numbers and the details. It's going to be too slow, so we're going to want perhaps a faster approach. We've talked about sequential search. You examine each element in an array, perhaps, or a list until you find it or find that it's not in there. Doing the analysis, we've already seen if there are n elements, on average you need n over 2. That means you're going to have to go halfway to have a 50-50 chance of finding it, the one you want. So the average case is n over 2. The worst case is n. You have to look at the very last one is the one that turns out to be correct. On the other hand, binary search is something we've learned about in various contexts, and we're going to set up data structures that support binary search effectively. Binary search is the old phone book lookup approach. And I feel kind of bad because you're probably the last generation. When I say phone book, you say, yeah, I know what that was. Is there an epic phone book or something where, you know, you have it in the listing on there and Aronson is there and Bailey is there and Charlton is there and Zelkowicz is at the back? It's all computerized, yeah. The university started getting away from it too. But I actually had a phone book delivered to me just the other day. Now, what's the best way to process a paper copy of a phone book these days? Yeah, well, actually, I do it in two steps. It was on my front door, so I walked, dropped it in front of my garage door. Why? Because what's behind the garage door? The trash cans. So the next time I pulled the car out, oh, what's that sitting there? That is something that goes to the trash man. Pick it up and drop it in the bucket. So a few years from now, none of you, you being the future students, if I'm teaching that long, will know about a phone book. But you've all seen one. And one of the things you kind of learn implicitly is how to search a phone book effectively. You certainly don't do a linear search unless you're in the smallest town that ever was. What happens is the old trick is you guess, you know, you look at the middle of the page. Well, first of all, if you know where your name is in the alphabet, you kind of guess the fraction of it. But basically, the trick is go to the halfway point. It's not necessarily M or N because names are not uniformly done. Does anybody know where the halfway point in the phone book is? No, it's a trick. So, neither do I. And since you don't have an Epic phone book, I can't test it. Shame on you. And I should have kept a book just for this purpose. But say M and N is the middle alphabet. And situation, you look at the middle point, and you're either in the top half or the bottom half. Split it again, top half or bottom half. And even though that's simplistic, that's immensely faster. Because each time you're cutting the search space in half, and then a quarter, then an eighth. And a lot of algorithms have that property, where they want to search a large amount of data by cutting it in half and half and half. Later in the semester, we'll talk about hashing, which is better still. Hashing is something that you use, and I believe in cache, you can actually use things like strings as a direct index into a more advanced kind of array, sometimes called a dictionary. But with hashing, you can sometimes do direct lookup. You simply say, here's the name I want, Jones. That's probably not so good. Let's take one that's not so common. Josephson, that's probably a little less common. And it searches directly for the right spot. If Josephson were in the directory, he or she would be there. If it's there, there may be some extra matches if there's a number of people with that name, or it may be empty, and you're there directly. So we're first going to do the phone book approach, and then we're going to do the more targeted approach that many programming languages are starting to implement. But they implement it using data structures that we're going to discuss and develop a little later in the semester. Notice that the binary search, by the way, is recursive. And that's kind of nice because, again, recursion normally means that we can use the same logic again and again and again, but on simpler and simpler and simpler data sets. So you want to find a value V, start at the midpoint, go to the upper half or lower half, and repeat. It turns out that by doing this half and half and half, your search time goes from N to log N, and that's an immense advantage, even for fairly small values. If, for example, N were 1024, that might be, certainly if we had an index of all the employees here, you have more than 1,000 employees, probably hire more than 1,000. How many do you hire in a given month? Is that number top secret? On the month, what's a good month? I mean, what's the head count? 300. More? 500? Wow, this. Does anybody ever get all these people and they're still rookies here and say, hey, I'll give you the secret about how to get the best meal. It only costs you a buck. No, you make too much money to do that. That's the stuff I would have done when I was in high school. So anyway, here's a case where if you had just 1,000 new employees and you're trying to find a particular one, maybe one of your friends is applying and you've got to give him or her the inside scoop of what to do and what not to do. So in that particular case, like, and Taco Tuesday, you don't go too late to lunch, right, because all the guacamole's gone. So in that particular case, notice the difference. If I did a linear search, I'd have to do something like half of 1,000. If I do this binary search, I'm down to 10, and that's quite feasible. So it is a significant difference. And if I could do something that got me directly to the entry, that'd be something like a unit time, and that'd be better still. So something we want to aim toward. So a binary search, as I outlined it with the phone book, requires that you do a comparison and say, am I bigger or smaller? That clearly works for numbers. It clearly works for names and the usual sort of thing where you compare last names, and then after last name, you use the first name as a subkey. But what about things that don't have such an obvious way of comparing? It turns out there's a way to compare objects, to define the comparison of objects, and an interface which says, here are objects, which may look pretty weird, but nevertheless are comparable. So for example, on an organization as big as this, just using names is not enough. It very well might be that there are two John Smiths working for the organization. But you could use a comparison that says, first check their names, and failing that, check their date of hire. I assume that's something that's recorded for purposes of seniority and pension plan. And you folks are way away from a pension, but believe me, it'll come at you at some point. And do a comparison to say, comparison rule one is check the names. That's comparable. Next is check dates. And certainly we know how to compare dates. Is this before, after, or equal? So what you would do is come up with an interface, and it's called the comparable. And it's parameterized by a type. strings are comparable, integers are comparable, but if you care to define it, lots of other things can be compared. Just way to differentiate, are you earlier, later, or an exact hit with respect to the particular information in an object? It turns out if you implement that interface, you only have to implement one method. So in this particular case, you have an integer. It's kind of odd because the reason you have to have an integer is because when I compare, I have not two possibilities, but three. I can be greater or less than or equal. We already have a type that does two values, binary, yes or no, true or false, bigger or not bigger, all sorts of things. But we really don't have a convenient metric for three values. People have actually studied that, but it's never quite caught on. There's something called three-value logic. And in many cases, you think about it, be having a yes and a no, have a third value is maybe, or I don't know, or something that is neither yes or no. So situation, your friend comes and let's go to lunch, and you don't particularly like that person, so you say yes, that's bad, because you don't want to go to lunch with somebody you don't like. Say no, they're going to get their feelings hurt. So you do the old things, well, not today, but maybe someday, and that works a lot. So they don't have a yes, no, and maybe in Java, but they have a way of doing a comparison that gives you three alternatives. It's less than, it's greater than, or it's equal. And let's see how that's done. So what we call that method is compare to. Again, this is object-oriented, so object S1 says, S1, compare yourself with S2, and give me one of those three possibilities. It'll give you an integer that's negative, probably -1, but I don't think they guarantee that, if it's less than. And that kind of makes sense, because negative is a lesser value. Gives you 0 if it's equal. That makes sense. You know, comparison is equal. And it gives you a positive value, probably +1, but I don't think that's guaranteed either, if it's greater. And now what you have is three choices. You get a number, it's negative, 0, or positive. And those are the way to respond. So now you can answer back the question, am I equal, less than, or greater, by doing a compare to and using that in your binary search. So let's take a look at that. To make a Java object comparable, we have to include the implements comparable class as part of the class definition. And if you thought, just, hey, there's a lot of interfaces there, one of the things I didn't mention, maybe your 302 instructor did, is that a class can implement many interfaces. So you can implement a list interface and also implement the class, the comparable interface. That just means you're going to provide enough methods to do the comparison and to do the usual list operations. And it's certainly possible to have 2, 3, 4, many different interfaces satisfied. That simply means that sometimes the object is going to do list-like things, and sometimes it's going to do comparison-like things, and you have both of those options available at an appropriate point in your program. So we'll have to define the compare to method in the class, and let's look at that. Let's do a class name, and what we'll do here is simply the usual compare your last name, and if you both happen to have the same last name, like Smith, we'll then compare the first name. You could then extend it, as I said a moment ago, to do something where it also would have, if you had a date of hire recorded in there, do a comparison on that. So I put in red here that it implements the comparable of a particular type. So it says name implements comparable name. In this case, I'm going to have two strings representing your first name and your last name. And here's our particular comparison thing. So what it's going to do is first the comparison on the last name, and then failing that on the first name. So it says, I'm going to compute the temp value, the thing I'm going to want to use in future. So in this case, I'm going to compare it with my last name. So my last name and your last name. If it's not equal to 0, then we're fine. So in that case, either your last name was greater than mine or less than mine, and the last name suffices. If they're equal, that means we had two Smiths. Who would ever guess that a company like this would have two Smiths in them? So in this case, I'll do a compare to of your first name and my first name, and hopefully that will differentiate. Now, again, if you needed a third criterion, you'd seem to go on, but this, I think, is enough to show you a little flavor of what's going on. So the takeaway of this is the binary search type stuff we're showing, or in general, the sort of things where I'm going to show you trees that have a key in them. I'm going to use simple things like a letter or a string or a number. But you're saying that's not very general. But in fact, anything that has a basis of comparison, like an employee record or some kind of medical record that we use it in this situation. I guess in the kind of medical records I use, or my physicians use, they use last name and date of birth, as I said, and that usually is sufficient. Unless, I guess, well, I wonder what they would do if they had two twins or born on the same day and had the same name. I don't know. What do you folks do? That's a possibility. You do medical records. Twins are not that uncommon. They're born in the same name. I guess what you do, last name, first name, and then a date of birth, that's probably sufficient. If somebody differentiates them by the middle name, you're in big trouble. So as I'm talking about trees, again, I'm going to do simple keys, but the last couple of slides say this is really pretty general. But it is going to mean that I'm going to have to be able to compare two things for being bigger, smaller, or equal. And as long as I can do that in a sensible way, that's fine. Now, of course, there's nothing implied by that. If your record is greater than mine, that does not mean that you get paid more or less or anything like that. It's simply a basis comparison. So don't read more into it that, hey, I'm greater than you are because my name's Zelkowitz and yours Aronson or something. Nothing silly like that. So trees are interesting because they break the pattern we've seen so far of data being laid out in a linear manner, both for arrays and for lists. We had a notion of somebody who was next, but next was always one value. In trees, you can have multiple values, and it happens that's such a general situation that it's very, very useful to have. So trees are nonlinear. That means more than one item may follow you. Let me illustrate that just so you're not too confused. One of the examples that people use trees for, and you may have done it, are family trees. And some people, you know, families have very accurate records about they're descended from so-and-so and so-and-so and so on. It used to be that a person could become a member of the Daughters of the American Revolution if you were descended by many generations from somebody who fought in the American Revolution. And they had sort of Sons of the Confederacy if you were descended from someone, and it could also be a daughter of Confederacy, who fought for the Confederate Army back in the Civil War, and lots of other things like that. So a tree has a notion of having a parent, but of course a parent may have several children. So kid one, kid two, and kid three, for example, and the kids can then have grandkids. Grandkids, let's get that right, and so on. So this is a nonlinear structure because many individuals can have the same parent. Maybe many grandchildren can have the same grandparent. So it's not a linear structure anymore, but it represents the fact that you can have multiple relationships encoded in one structure. So more than one item can follow each other. In this case, a parent can have kid one, kid two, and kid three, all in the relationship a parent of. And each one of those could be thought of in some sense of next. I can go from my parent to the child to the grandchild in just two steps. Now, so that gives me the ability to get to certain pieces of data much quicker than if it was linear. That's one of the reasons why that binary search is so fast. I can skip by unnecessary items very quickly if they don't quite match my criteria for a match. The number of items can vary. We'll talk about one special case called a binary tree. And this is generally the simplest form of tree. This is a node. This is a situation where a parent has one child or two children, but no more. Clearly, in the case of family trees, that doesn't make sense. But in other structures where you can limit it to one choice or another, it makes a lot of sense. So, for example, if I'm searching, you can imagine I have one child that represents all the data that compare less than me. The other child represents all the data that compares greater than me. And there's little old me right in the center where I ought to be. So in that case, the number of items can vary. And as I mentioned, trees are used for a variety of purposes. Family trees are one that you are probably familiar with. Surprisingly, they can be used to show the structure of a program. I won't say too much about that yet, but if you ever look at a program, as complex as it is, you may have wondered, how can anybody ever analyze that program automatically, perhaps understand what it does? The class I teach other than this one is the introduction to compilers, and I may teach that in future sometime, and if you're unlucky enough, you may not be able to avoid it. But in that case, one of the very first things we do is show how to distribute the structure of a program into a tree-like structure. That means I can separate pieces of information that are declarations from pieces of information that are methods. I can separate methods into statements. I can separate statements into expressions. I can separate expressions into operands and on down in such a way that I can take an entire program, which just looks like a linear sequence of characters, or actually two-dimension, on a page, and break it down into a tree structure that represents exactly what that program means. That's a very important step to analyzing a program and saying, is this valid or invalid? Can I execute it properly or not? How do I execute it? So if I teach this course again and you happen to be in the audience, we'll talk about that for sure. It can represent decision logic. In the old days, they used to teach how to program by doing some sort of flow charting or logic diagrams. And even though that's not done much anymore, it turns out to be a convenient way to organize a plan of attack. So you might have a situation there that says, I want to go ahead and get myself a new car. So first question I says is, have money. And there's a yes and a no. The no means I could come back here and teach some more classes. It says, yes, I get the situation where I ask myself, is it a coupe or an SUV? One path says coupe. Other is SUV. And notice there's many other alternatives here, so I could have something also that was convertible. And I'm sure all of you either have done this logic or will soon, and then you ask the situation, is it going to be a domestic or an imported, and on and on and on. So tree structure, we can organize a way to make a complex decision. Why did I decide that I wanted this one? Get down to the cool things about what color is it going to be, and how great a stereo does it have, and all kinds of stuff. And you can do that step by step by step using tree-like logic. And the thing I'll be talking most about right now is fast access to data, because I can go down the structure and bypass irrelevant data very quickly and get to the relevant data very quickly. So let's look at a tree and we'll have some notation definition. Trees in computer science are kind of odd because the root of the tree, as it's called, is at the top. So you can think of the tree as kind of hanging upside down. It's mostly because when we draw things, we go from top to bottom, and that kind of fits that. So in this case, the tree starts out with what's called the root, only one root, and that is at the top. A tree may have children. In this case, it has three of them, B, I, and C. Children may have other children and on the way down. And in general, each of these entities is called a node. The very start of a tree, there's only one of them, is called the root, but it's a node. At the bottom of a tree, there are nodes that have no children at all. Those are called leaves. And that kind of makes sense if you think of this in inverted. As you go up a tree, it has branches, 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 and finally you hit leaves. Come on, guy. Got to hit just the right spot. So we're out of time, so what we'll do next time is finish up. So actually, a little bit of what I start next time will be included on the midterm, but the midterm's not until 2 weeks away, so certainly a little bit of extra we have to cover will be covered early in next session.